Classical gravity, and we do that, you know, the motivation for doing that is that we want to go through canonical quantization as one quantization framework, and that helps not only with interpretation, but actually we will also use canonical quantization to derive covariant quantization. So basically we needed to do lots of quantization and to develop actually a framework for quantum geometry. And we have seen basically yesterday that we get in our 3D quantum gravity case, we get these canonical coordinates. And these are actually exactly the same coordinates you get in 4D. And you get a Gauss constraint and the so-called flatness constraint. And these constraints which I've written there again, you see that these are just some components of the equation of motion. So these are the equation, these are some equation of motions expressed in phase space variables. Which then appear without any time derivatives. And that makes them kind of unusual from the perspective of equation of motion. And basically, it means that in your phase space, know, which is higher dimensional, but of course I cannot really draw a very high dimensional phase space, you will have a constrained hypersurface where all the constraints are vanishing, and it's only these points which lie on the constrained hypersurface. Can lead to solutions because, you know, the constraints are just equation of motion. Okay. And I think the last thing I told you yesterday is that we could also identify a Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian was a linear combination of the flatness constraint and the Gauss constraint. And such systems, which are typically for diffeomorphism-invariant systems, are called totally constrained. And we had these funny variables, which, you know, act as Lagrange multipliers in the action. And we will basically identify their function later on as gauge parameters, as we will see. So that's what we had yesterday. Is there any questions to this stuff? Because now we are going to deal with these constraints. Okay. No questions. Okay, now we have this funny Hamiltonian which vanishes. So this is related, you might have learned, I'm not sure, that the concept of energy in general relativity is not very clear, and this is related to these problems, that the definition of energy is not straightforward to obtain. And if you would here calculate the Hamiltonian, you get actually that energy, you know, as is usually defined, namely being the Hamiltonian vanishes. And you might be a bit worried that your theory is now trivial. However, you know, also we have that this needs to be zero for solutions your system is non-trivial. Because it will lead leads to a non-trivial flow. And the point of this lecture is to show you that we can identify this flow. So this flow is in the sense I explained yesterday with gauge transformations. Okay, and it will turn out that these parameters here, these variables, if you basically use that to write your equations of motion or your time evolution equations, these can be chosen arbitrarily. So I will actually rename them. And I will split the Hamiltonian because we will see, since they can be chosen arbitrarily and they will generate gauge transformations, we can consider these two parts separately. And so now I'm going to show you. Actually, I will start with the Gauss constraints. That these combinations for arbitrary variables E and A generate gauge transformations. And to do that, I introduce the so-called smeared constraints. Here it's a smeared Gauss constraint. So I will denote that by lambda. And lambda j will be a scalar with an internal index j. And that will be just defined as a so-called smearing. That just means that you integrate the Gauss constraint against your scalar function lambda j over your hypersurface. Okay. And that, okay, I will write it here, is defined as this expression. So this is a phase space function. And as such, it generates a flow. And what we are interested in was, what is the change of our basic variables under this flow? And we had yesterday, all these things vanished. That was not a good choice. Oh, that was okay. Change to the right hand side. So we had yesterday basically that every phase space function generates a flow, and we can consider the infinitesimal change of another phase space function under the influence of this flow. And this is given by the Poisson bracket. So if I am interested in the infinitesimal change, which I write as delta lambda, because we had this notion before, so it should remind you of something, of semi-triad variables under this Gauss constraint, Let's call that B. Okay. At the point X, which, you know, is defined as the Poisson bracket of my basic variables of the triad under the smeared Gauss constraint with lambda here. And now I have to compute this Poisson bracket. And, you know, Poisson brackets is a linear operation. It commutes with many things, and in particular with integration. So we can put this integral outside. And we have E here. So it commutes with E. E commutes with E. The only term which it doesn't commute is A. So we have E, B, K, X. And then we have lambda J, Y, epsilon G, M, F. Sorry, so here it should be an M. Here should be an L. Okay, and this is all at, you know, phase space function fields at Y. Poisson bracket integral over Y. So lambda is just the parameter here. So this can be just put outside the Poisson bracket. Epsilon is also just a constant, can be put outside. Does not commute with A, this is connection, commutes with this E. So everything except for this A can be put outside, and we know that E with A gives basically two Kronecker's times a delta function. Which I've so E with A gives actually minus a delta function. Lots of deltas. So we will find lambda if this delta function f a minus epsilon j m l and we should take care of our Kronecker deltas. So here we have B and A. So we get a B here. And we have M and K. So we have a K here. And we find that this is given by minus lambda j epsilon jkl ebl evaluated at x. Okay. And that might remind you of something. Since I used already the symbol, okay, so later on, Now I tell you now, this actually will turn out to agree with the rotations which we discussed as symmetries of the action and these we discussed for the co-triads. However, if one goes to the formula, like, you know, E was a function of the co-triads, basically with a two-dimensional Levi-Civita contracted, and checks how these rotations work there, and then pulls that away, one will find that this is exactly how these triads should change under rotation. These variables, capital E, should change under rotation. Okay. So this holds for the E fields. Well, it was also always the wrong choice of blackboard. And we have another variable, which is the connection. So let us check also how a connection changes under the influence of the Gauss constraint. And this is again the same kind of calculation. Yeah, it's a bit. I think it is the last one. I cannot really erase it. Okay, so that is again defined as Gauss constraint for some bracket of the connection with the Gauss constraint. So let me write again the Gauss constraint. And now it's slightly more complicated. So sorry, let me call that B and K. So this is all evaluated at y, integral over y. And we have to compute the Poisson bracket between these two expressions. And the only slightly more complicated point is that we know that A does not commute the connection, does not commute with E. And we have a derivative here appearing on E. But that's one reason why one always kind of smears these constraints. Either one works with derivatives applied to delta functions, or one just uses integration by parts. Yeah. Yeah. Conveniently forgotten. Thanks. Thank you. So this part of the integral, you know, you do integration by part and get rid of the derivative, and now you just have one wonderful triad variable e here. So now you just apply, you know, calculate this Poisson bracket, and again now basically A eliminates this E here and this E here. And we get a delta function and so on. So we will find lambda j dA lambda j that becomes an A k and that a B via the Kronecker deltas . So again, A becomes a B. And here, you know, this lambda, these internal indices can be pulled down and up with the Kronecker delta. So this ML will become a K. So again, check your notes or my notes on how the connection transforms under rotation of the triad variables, and you will find exactly this formula, just that it was with omega and the mu index, but this mu index is not even touched. So we just for mu equal to b, the spatial index. So this again is a rotation, infinitesimal rotation in the internal index. This parameter lambda j. So lambda j defines you exactly which Lie algebra element or exponentiate group element you have to consider. So what we have learned is that the Gauss constraints generate rotations and we discussed earlier that these rotations are gauge transformations. Okay. So we discussed it for the Gauss constraints. Now we can already have a suspicion for the flatness constraints, that they might also generate something. And you can guess what it is. Or read my notes. Okay, the flatness constraints, you know, they depend only on the connection. So how do they act on a connection? one of the zero answers. Okay, so let's define again the smeared flatness constraints, which I will call f of n. And let's consider the infinitesimal change under the flatness constraints, which I will denote by delta n of the connection under the flatness constraints. Which was defined as, again, you know, now my phase space function is just given by this flatness constraint. And I have to take the Poisson bracket with of my connection. With my flatness constraints. And I will get zero. With all the components of the connection commute with each other. I was never telling you this, but these things commute with each other. Okay. And okay, so we see that the flatness constraints leave the connection invariant. And if you go a bit, few pages back in your notes or my notes, and you know, check, we discussed three kinds of gauge transformations. And one gauge transformation was leaving the connection invariant. And I call this gauge transformation. Translation symmetry. So all modulo is sine. So I think there's a one sine difference, but that doesn't matter because you can always redefine your parameters. And at some point, I dropped the sign in changing the E0 components and A0 components with the smearing functions, lambda and n. So we are just left with, you know, okay, now we have a suspicion. It is the flatness constraints. The flatness constraints generate the translations, and we should check this on our other variable, which we have. And these are the triad variables. And so I have to write the connection. AC FnNg, an integral, and the Poisson bracket. Okay, so here. Okay, so we have the same thing which we had before. We have E as a basic variables. It does not commute with this term and these terms. And here it's a derivative. So we do the same as before. We do integration by parts and put it here. And here we have two A's and just, you know, apply the Leibniz rule. And do two lines of calculation. And you will find that you get this result, and again, if you check, you know, how did translations act on our variables EA, KA. So that was actually adding a covariant derivative. Them. So that is plus minus, depending on convention here. And EKA, these EBK, were defined by an epsilon E so here I can't remember. Whether it's AB or BA. So here we see this covariant derivative appearing. And this epsilon is just this epsilon, which appears in our, you know, transformation from these densitized triad variables to these co-triads. So the flatness constraints with smearing parameter n, they act on the basic variables as a translation, you know, like a translation symmetry, the generate translation symmetry. And since they do it on all of our phase space variables, we can conclude that this holds in general for all phase space variables or for all phase space functions. So the flatness constraints generate translation symmetry. Okay, so we have seen that the Gauss constraints generate rotations and the flatness constraints generate translation symmetry. And these are gauge symmetries. The Hamiltonian is some linear combination of these of the flatness constraints and the Gauss constraints. So the Hamiltonian generates gauge symmetries or for fixed parameters for these fixed variables, our zero components of the connection and the triad, a particular gauge symmetry. And this gauge symmetry is identified with time evolution. And for, you know, first time you might hear that, it might be very puzzling and people were usually wondering about it a lot. It basically means that time evolution is a gauge symmetry. And that problem sometimes is, comes under the problem of frozen time. But this is not so, so puzzling if you remember that gauge symmetries were defined to map physically equivalent solutions to physically equivalent solutions. And what we did in our canonical analysis was to say, so now this is space-time. You know, we say we in our canonical analysis, we pick a hypersurface here and assume you have a solution on your space-time. So this solution, you know, leads to initial data on your hypersurface. So these initial data lead to a phase space point. Which, since it's a solution, it's automatically on the constrained hypersurface. And now what we do on a time evolution, we evolve this hypersurface to here. And what time evolution means in canonical language is that what I get here is my evolution of these initial data or of this phase space point to the data which I have here. So they, you know, they're not any more initial, but in the literal sense, but they still define you a phase, another phase space point. And you get this phase space point as basically a result of your Hamiltonian flow from this phase space point. And what we just say is that this phase space point is physically equivalent to this phase space point. And that just means that they describe the same solution. But they do describe the same solution because, you know, just seen as a four-dimensional thing, it is the same solution. Yeah. So for the spatial, yeah. So you know, in the notes which you don't have now, I actually show. So it's a good question. So I jump a bit, but it actually turns out that indeed, if you take a combination of of the flatness and the rotation constraints, you get, you know, the get actually Hamiltonian and the diffeomorphism constraints. So I now have, you know, want you to believe me in this point. And in my lecture notes, I actually have a section on that, but we won't have time to go through the section. But you can do that as a homework. It was actually also planned at some homework at some point. And you know, this, so it's actually this representation, which is, you know, you go to some constraints which generate really normal deformation, so time evolution in normal direction, and spatial diffeomorphisms. And these constraints are called really the proper Hamiltonian constraint and the diffeomorphism constraint. And they have a very nice geometric interpretation and lead to the so-called hypersurface deformation algebra. And I can only mention that now. And you can read my notes. It's a very beautiful subject, but we won't have time to go through that. But in general, you know, so actually, if you take these, if you take reasonable parameters E0, J, these will generate time transformations in the sense that they define you some arbitrary slicing. So different E, different parameters here, they describe you different wigglings, how you can basically move your hypersurface up and down. Yeah.
So what you're saying with the gauge symmetry, like time evolution to gauge symmetry, is like, okay, if I have a solution in this, in this type of surface and I evolve it, they, I guarantee that it's going to be a useful solution.
You get, you know, you get new, you evolve it, you get a new phase space point.
Yes.
You can take this phase space point and evolve it to full solution. And you find the same, you find two different solutions, but you can map these solutions by coordinate transformations or by coordinate transformation plus maybe internal rotations into each other. You know, it actually, this always happens if you have time, the time coordinate can always change by reparametrization or by shifting. So actually, already in the full covariant formalism, you can somehow expect that because you can always make a coordinate transformation where you just shift your time parameter by some value like 5, you know, and you get a new solution in principle. You know, but this solution, you would say, is physically equivalent to the previous solution because the only thing what you did is that you slightly changed your notion of busy clock or coordinate, time coordinate. And this is what is reflected here. You know, and phase space, it's this notion of phase space. You usually don't learn that, but phase space actually is there to give you a typically it's there to give you one-to-one parametrization of the space of solutions. So typically, you know, phase space means that you actually want to have a space of solutions, but you want to have that parameterized in a convenient way. And it just means that these two different phase space points, they give you the same solution. So solution means not only forward evolution, but you also have to, you know, backward evolve backward. And then depending on what happens, you might go into Big Bang or to Big Crunch or have infinite long solution, which you can extend to infinity. But in this sense, you get the same solution.
I would just say so that if you're gonna, if I give my whole plane time and I put the slice of this surface, so all the solutions in all surface are the same.
No, all the initial, so you pick a solution here. Solution, I mean, it's something, in this case, three dimensional, but it's, you know, the full space time. And this solution, you're picking different hypersurfaces, You know, this solution picks you different, gives you on the different hypersurfaces, you get different initial data, just in the sense that here a solution means fields e mu, e or e mu k k, and here it's really x0, xa, x0, xa. Now this means a solution. So these satisfying equation, these would be these fields satisfying equation of motion. So now pick different, you know, fix your x0. Oh. So call that t and consider these fields, which you know, compute this capital E from the small e's by applying Levi-Civita. You get canonical data, and you might expect that changing t, you get different canonical data. You get different phase space points. But they come all from the same solution. No. So in this sense, they describe you the same physical solution. And actually, in the tutorial today, yesterday, you might have done the parameterized particle. And it's the same thing is happening there. So in the parameterized particle, you had also some time parameter. Did you call it S, T? I don't know. Tau, the losy time, the bad time. OK. And you got also an Hamiltonian, which was a, you know, vanishing. It was a constraint. And the same was happening there, that actually, if you add this additional time parameter, you get a physical system in which you get an gauge equivalence, which also gives you the time evolution. So just, you know, just this phenomenon. And we will discuss the parameterized particle again. And we will see that from the parameterized particle, you get back to the usual system. You know, it's more a philosophical thing that you have time translations as gauge transformations, which you also have in the covariant formalism. You know, it's basically just time translation. You can see it as a coordinate transformation. Okay. So let me draw this picture. So one thing which I haven't shown you, and which is partially homework, or to a large extent homework, again, you might have a look at the notes. It's a consistency check, because I told you we have constraints, the flatness and the Gauss constraints. And then I told you there's a time evolution, or that these constraints generate gauge transformations. And assume you take your phase space point, which is on the constraint hypersurface, and you evolve it, and it's a gauge transformation. But you would like to do a consistency check, namely that this point remains on the constraint hypersurface. Because otherwise, you know, if you're off the constraint hypersurface, you are in a region which doesn't even correspond to a solution. So as a consistency check, you would like that the flow generated by the constraints leaves the constraint hypersurface invariant, And the constraint hypersurface, you know, was defined by the vanishing of these constraints. And now we want to check whether the flow of the constraints leaves the constraints invariant. So what would we have to check? Indeed. So basically, yeah, yesterday I told you, so these are, you know, to compute the action of the constraints or what the constraint flow does with the basic variables, you have to take Poisson brackets. But remember that yesterday I told you we can also use the Poisson brackets to get what a constraint or a Hamiltonian flow does on a more complicated function of your phase space. It's the same Poisson bracket that just comes from applying the chain rule. So we would have to check, you know, so in principle, the change of, say, the Gauss constraint smeared with lambda prime under the flow of the Gauss constraint smeared with lambda. Now, you know, we do the same thing. We take a Gauss constraint smeared with lambda prime and take the Poisson bracket with G lambda. And this should be something.
Zero.
This should be zero everywhere. Should it be zero everywhere or? So we are on the constrained hypersurface. And you know, we would like that the constraint hypersurface, that this value of the constraint doesn't change. So if we get something proportional to the constraints, we are not so much interested in that. So we just have to require zero on the constraint hypersurface. So let me draw a picture. And indeed, it turns out that this is equal to a Gauss constraint again. Of course, I have different notations. And that is epsilon JLM lambda J lambda L. So I won't manage to do the computation anyway today. And anyway, that's part of the homework. But you have also these miraculous nodes. So this, of course, is zero on the constraint hypersurface, because it's a constraint. And what you get, so this means if you are on the constraint hypersurface here, at least just with the Gauss constraints now, and you know, evolve your phase space point with the Gauss constraint, you remain on the constraint hypersurface. So you get a flow which basically goes along this constraint hypersurface. And these flow lines will be called gauge orbits. So actually gauge orbits will be here, you know, for arbitrary gauge parameters, all phase space points which you can give, which you can get from a given phase space point by choosing arbitrary lambdas will define the gauge orbit. So gauge orbit basically is all the set of gauge equivalent phase space points. To a given phase space point 2p, and that is the gauge orbit through p. So we get this picture, at least I told you that with respect to the Gauss constraints, you have this picture. So this computation is, you know, you have at least to compute something. So for say the flatness constraints, what do you expect? Yeah, well, yeah, you expect the same, and what do you expect? What you get as a result if you take the Poisson brackets of the flatness constraints with each other. Look at the flatness constraints. It's a quantitative answer. Question, zero. There was a very faint zero. So the flatness constraints, they commute kind of a trivially, in a sense, they're just function of the connection. No triad variables appear, and connection commutes with connection. And and the last thing you would have to check is, how does a flatness constraint change under the Gauss constraint? You know, and this is given by the Poisson bracket of Gauss constraint with flatness constraint. And this is given, this is minus the flatness constraint with the Gauss constraint. So what it also gives you at the same time is how a Gauss constraint changes under the influence of the Gauss of the flatness constraint. And again, this is an explicit computation, which is part of the homework. Almost, yeah. Modulo in epsilon. So we defined it this. So this is a plus. So we actually get that this is equal to the Gauss flatness constraint. You know, I told you that actually you can conclude that very easily because I told you that the Gauss constraint. Not very easily. I told you that the Gauss constraint generates rotations, and the flatness constraint is basically the curvature tensor with an internal index. And you can conclude that what happens is that this curvature tensor is rotated, and this defines you again a flatness constraint, but just rotated in the internal index. So it gives you a flatness constraint with parameters nj. J, M, K, lambda K. So basically, N, you get the new parameter here, n prime m, and this is the definition of n prime m, and it's given by nje epsilon lambda k. So this you get by explicitly calculating the algebra, and that is part of the homework, yeah, or reading, yeah. Here? Here? So I defined always, it's a convention, but I defined always, you know, the action. Oh, yeah. Sorry, you are right. So maybe there's a plus here, and there's minus here. You are right. It's confusing my. So that is f n is g of lambda, and okay, you get actually a minus sign here. Okay. So this defines you actually so-called constraint algebra. And I will comment more on that next time. And actually, that will be a short comment. And we will go after that. Actually, we will see how to quantize these systems with constraints, because it's a bit more non-trivial than having no constraints around. And after that, we can actually quantize, go on and quantize 2+1 gravity. And the tools which we need are exactly the same as quantizing 4D gravity, because it's the same structures which we need there. OK. Yeah?
Can I clarify what you wrote in the G? Is it lambda epsilon JLM lambda prime J?
Lambda. Yeah, I forgot a prime. Yeah, I guess it is lambda prime J, lambda L.
Thank you.